beautiful people, welcome to this week's episode of the Montpelier Happy Hour here on WVEW LP Brattleboro. I'm your host and producer of the show, Olga Peters, and this is where we like to talk about how everything in Montpelier shakes out for the rest of us. And like it's on many people's minds right now is ed funding. So I am very happy to go straight to introducing two folks from the Public Assets Institute based in Montpelier. Many people may recognize Stephanie Yu, who is the executive director. So glad you can join us, Steph.
Thanks for having me.
And then very happy to meet Jack Hoffman, who is a senior policy analyst also at Public Assets Institute, who recently posted on the website a short piece, but very informative, called Education Reform Redo, that gets into some of the thoughts on, some of Public Assets' thoughts on H454, which is the main ed funding. It's not even ed funding. There's also some structural changes in there too. It's gone through the House, and I think it's now with the Senate Ed Committee right now. So without further ado, thank you, Jack. Thank you, Steph, for being here. Quickly, Stephanie, before we jump into conversations, because I think it's always good for listeners to know this, when Public Assets Institute is looking at data and looking at policy that's coming out of Montpelier, what's the framework you tend to work with? You know, are you looking for certain outcomes or outcomes that achieve certain things for Vermonters? Like, what's your framework?
Sure. So, I mean, we're starting with, you know, we're thinking about economic security for all Vermonters, but we're also, when we look at the revenue system, we're really thinking about what's the fairest way to have the revenue, what's the fairest revenue system we can have. And that means a progressive system. It means that people with a greater ability to pay should contribute more. So that applies across all the, you know, all of the taxes, all of the revenue system. And we're always thinking about ways to make that stronger. I will add here, too, that I know we're going to talk about education funding, and I think it's a huge topic. It's an important topic. And I think sometimes we do a disservice to the topic of public education by having so many of the conversations be about how we pay for it and the tax side of it and not about what we want our kids to get out of it. So we are also trying to keep that kind of balance of the conversation in mind, even though our focus is really on how we pay for it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Jack, anything you'd like to add to that?
Well, you know, over the years, we also look at how the money is distributed, too, which has been a big fact. I mean, you want to make sure that the taxes are raised fairly and to make sure that the money is then distributed in a way so that, you know, all kids get the resources they need.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate you both being here today. And just a note, I don't normally plan shows like this, but I reached out to Steph and Jack because I really like their post on the website they did that we'll get into a little bit more, and I will also put in the show notes. And then Emily also said, oh, hey, let's talk about this. And so next week, Emily will be on the show. So I'm hoping if we come up with some questions here, we can then share them with Emily next week. But one reason I'm interested in this topic is there is this sense of urgency right now. A lot of folks are feeling that property taxes are way too high, and we have seen some significant jumps for a lot of reasons over the past couple years. But then there's also a lot of folks who just feel the education system in general is under stress. Enrollment's declining, but also with COVID and everything and upheaval at the federal level, there's just a lot of stress in the system. I also find this is just, it feels like education is one place where Vermont's ideals and our ability to pay really mesh. And sometimes when they mesh, it's a conflict. And sometimes when they mesh it, it's a beautiful thing. But I do find education is just one of those places where our ideals and our money really are kind of trying to figure it out and dance it out, which makes me wonder, before we even get into the conversation around H454, what do you feel is a fair expectation to have around our education and our education funding? For example, I see Steph looking at me like, eh. A lot of folks are like, t property taxes keep going up. This is true. But there's also cost of living and things, built into a lot of systems. So is it fair to expect property taxes to stay level for years on end, for example? I don't know. What, any thoughts from you?
Yeah, there's a lot in there, and I'm sure Jack has thoughts too. But I would start by saying that, we've been looking at education funding over the years, over the decades, and it's pretty flat adjusted for inflation, right? So that means we're spending the same amount of our state resources on education as we have been all along. And even when you kind of take into account declining enrollment, it's pretty flat, like 1% a year adjusted for inflation, and the staff ratios are staying pretty similar over time, right? Like, so we're shrinking the amount of teachers to reflect the amount of kids as that's happening. But FY25, the current year, as you know, was definitely a big jump, and there were a lot of factors in that, and Jack can speak more specifically to that. So I think it's worth noting that we're not putting more effort into education than we were. I think you also made this good point that, we've had a long time commitment to public education, and that's sort of a regional thing too, right? A lot of the New England states spend more on education than, say, the Southeast or other areas. So, that's been true as long as we've been tracking this stuff, that we've been kind of contributing this same share. But I think to your point, the part of the question is, okay, but are the people who are paying for it the same people? And I think what we've been looking at is the fact that low and moderate income Vermonters get squeezed more by school taxes, and that's actually gotten worse in recent years because of a lot of factors that we can dive into. But so it's not so much that the total system, the cost is growing, it's that we think it's squeezing the wrong people. So what do we do about that? So that's a different problem to solve than this, than saying that we're spending too much writ large on education.
That, thank you so much for that, Steph, because I think for a lot of people, their emotional experience of the ed system would be very different.
I think it's fair to say that taxes are squeezing a lot of people, but that's not the same thing as we're spending too much. How can we fix that squeeze and still have a good conversation about what we want our public education system to deliver and how to deliver it?
Thank you. What would you like to add to that, Jack?
No, I think that's an important point. I think this comes as a surprise to a lot of people, but over years, but we've looked at it in various ways. And actually, there was a chart that was produced by the Joint Fiscal Office sometime in the last year. I can't remember exactly when it was, but this looked at education funding adjusted for inflation. They used a New England inflation adjustment. But it showed things were, essentially flat. Again, there clearly was a rise for FY 2025, but I think that the agency, identified some, pretty obvious cost drivers. I mean, it didn't make it any easier to pay for them, but at least we could understand where the money went and what was causing increases. But we've looked at this in various ways. We've looked at education spending as a percentage of the gross state product. So sort of compare our what we're spending on education compared to the size of our economy. We've looked at that with the gross state product. We've looked at it against personal income. And it always shows the same thing. I mean, we really haven't put any greater effort into funding education, for a good, 20 or 30 years. And
Wow.
I mean, it's true that this is being spent now on fewer kids, but as Steph mentioned, even when you take that into account, per pupil spending after adjusting for inflation, It's a pretty modest increase. Again, as Steph said, it's about 1% a year. And you know, when you look at a common thing we've heard, for years, and I've been covering this for a long time, and at least for the last 15 or 20 years, people have talked about, all the additional things that schools are required to do. They're a lot of society's problems end up in the schools, and the schools have to deal with them. So those are placing additional costs. And so we've managed to absorb those costs. We've managed to absorb increases in healthcare costs, for example, that everybody experiences, but teachers do as well. And still, I think, we've managed to cover those things without really increase, again, adjusted for inflation, we really aren't spending that much more than we were 20 years ago.
Wow.
So, but people see their taxes going up. I'm not trying to say that, people aren't seeing tax increases or they aren't feeling tax increases. This is somewhat anecdotal, but there are also some local tax increases. Checking some things last year, some municipal taxes went up, took some big jumps. I don't know what was behind that. Inflation has been a new factor in recent years. This is something that, a lot of people aren't used to dealing with, inflation. So that was a problem. The other cost driver, the healthcare was identified as a big cost driver, and the mental health services was another big contributor to the increase for 25. So again, it doesn't make it any easier to know what was pushing up your costs, but at least we can understand it.
Thank you. Well, I'd like to turn to specifically H five. See, I did it. 454. It's a very large bill. I certainly have not made my whole way through it yet. But in your post, Jack, you asked two questions that really stood out to me that I think is important because there has been a lot of talk in the press about like how maybe the governor is suggesting one thing and the House is suggesting another. But it sounded to me in your post that there are some things in common. And one of them is how the ed funding would impact how people would pay for it, whether it would be property taxes or income tax. And then also, what level would there still remain of what level of local control would still remain? And those that really stood out to me because I think that feels core to a lot of people that ed funding should be based on people's ability to pay and that there should be some local control. I think a lot of people feel that way. So could we talk about those two aspects, and
Yeah,
how they
well,
would change or not?
I think I'll just say, I think that we wanted to provide a little context to the whole discussion. As you say, so far, what we, the governor came out with his, he was the first one with a new proposal, and all the discussion has been, the governor's new plan versus the legislature's new plan, and it's taken a little while for the legislature's to take shape, but there really hasn't been much discussion about, how did these plans compare to what we have now, or what's going to change. So, I wanted to make those bring that into the discussion, that these are pretty dramatic changes that, our current system we've had since 1997, for a lot of people, this is the only funding system they've known. And so I just wanted to remind them that, a One of the important things we did in 1997 was move to this system that was allowed more people to pay their school taxes based on their ability to pay, i.e. their income. It was tied to income. And we're really not going to have that under the two under the plans that the governor has proposed. Now, they do bring in income. I mean, it's a factor, but it's not the same. It's still going to be a property tax system. There'll be discounts for people depending on their income, but it in no way really mirrors what we have now, which is a system that's based on your ability to pay. It's really tied to your income. So with this new plan, property taxes vary, and I think for a lot of people, incomes go up and their property values go up. I don't think they don't necessarily get way out of whack for a lot of people, but there are people for whom, their income doesn't keep pace with the increase in their property values. And I mean, this is a problem that Vermont actually started dealing with, more than 50 years ago. It started with, we had seniors with on fixed incomes. Vermont started to become a tourist destination. A lot of people wanted to move here. Property values went up, and people were getting pushed out of their homes because they couldn't pay their property taxes. So, it's a very different system that's when you base it on property as opposed to income. And I just wanted to remind people, that we should think about that. Do people really want to give up this system that's based on ability to pay?
But I think it's, and if I could jump in here, I don't know if you want to move on to something else, but
No,
in
please
terms
do.
of 454, right? Like I do, I think Jack's piece did say it well, but I think the three big structural changes that the governor and the House plans have in common are one, they're going to a foundation system similar to what we had before 1997. There's some key differences, but where essentially Montpelier decides how much everybody spends. So that's one piece. The other piece is significant consolidation, right? The governor was proposing five districts. The House is proposing, they haven't decided yet, but they're looking at somewhere 2021 in that neighborhood. So significant consolidation from where we are, which is, over 100 districts at the moment. And then the third area that Jack mentioned is this leaning into a property tax. So really getting rid of income sensitivity as we know it and making it much more driven by the value of your home. There are still some income-based adjustments, but it starts with the property value rather than what we have now, which really is an income-based system for most people. So those are pretty significant changes, and I think we want to be clear if, are those the right move? We have a lot of concerns. I think the House is doing, part of the problem with foundation, and it's worth noting before Jack worked at Public Assets, he was a longtime reporter on the State House beat. So he's been following this stuff for a really long time and probably remembers, the pre-Brigham days better than a lot of us. But I think it's worth noting that the reason we got the system we have is because the foundation system before 1997 created such stark disparities, because it was basically a ceiling for poor towns and a floor for rich towns, right? And the House is taking steps to kind of calm that down and maybe limit those disparities, but there's still a ton of questions about, it's sort of they're looking at kind of a formulaic way of doing of setting that foundation amount. It's sort of a computer-driven model. It's adjusted for inflation, which may or may not work. If the cost of teacher healthcare continues to grow faster than inflation, that won't keep up. And I think there's also still a lot of questions about how the money gets distributed within these giant districts, right? You've got big districts with towns that haven't worked together before, and you got to figure out how to distribute the money within those districts. So there's a whole bunch of sort of concerns and questions. And on those big structural changes, the governor and the House are pretty close together.
Thank you for that clarity, Steph. Really appreciate it. Yeah, I have vague memories of pre-Brigham versus post-Brigham. I'm being a Gen Xer, but I think for me, I one thing that really stands out, because I grew up in a rural community with a lot of farms, that when Brigham first happened, a lot of farmers just like lost their minds because they were land rich, but it didn't mean that their income was reflected in that. So that's just one memory about the early days of Brigham that stands out for me. Anything you'd like to add, Jack?
No, we didn't get into this a lot in this blog, but I think we still haven't come to grips with consolidation in the state. I think both of these plans are, I mean, it's really going to take consolidation to a whole new level. And unfortunately, a lot of this stuff gets measured in dollars and cents. And everybody's looking for quote unquote efficiency in education funding, but it's the people who push back against consolidation are really worried about what it's going to do to local communities and the cohesion of local communities. And I think we need to figure out a way to bring that into the conversation, and not have it, I mean, I don't know that you can place a dollar value on that, and so it makes it very hard to, argue in favor of this very important social and community, factor, and putting that up against dollars and cents. And I have to say, I think that I mean, I was on the school board after I stopped reporting. I served a few terms on my local school board, and I think there are parts of the state that really don't appreciate the benefits and the quality of education that kids actually get in small town in small communities. I think there's a lot of focus on the equipment and maybe offerings in the curriculum that maybe small schools can't offer, but there are a lot of other things that they do offer in the small communities. That I think just aren't appreciated in some of the bigger towns around the state. And I think that all of that needs to be brought into this discussion when we're, everybody seems to be bent on these much bigger districts that I think we really need to question or look at how much that may discourage public participation, democratic participation. People used to complain about how many, I can't remember, when the like 1500 school board members in the state of Vermont for 85,000 kids. I always thought that was great, that we had you have you we have that many people in the state who want to take part. I mean, it's not like it cost a lot of money to pay these school board members, but I thought that was a plus to have lots of school boards and lots of school board members. So I think we should be careful before we throw all that away.
I
Can
think
I come back
you
to
raised
your
some.
comment? Or sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say thank you, Jack, that I think you do raise a good point, and you touch on how this isn't just about money, as well. This is about communities. And yes, Steph, please.
Yeah, I just wanted to come back to your comment about sort of the farmers after Brigham and some of the concerns. And I think you're raising a good point. I mean, part of it, how we treat residential property and how we treat property that's put to different uses is sort of a whole other question. We could have a whole hour on that.
And
But I
it's very
think
different than it was in
it's
1997,
very
too.
different than it was in 1997. But I think it's also, but I think you're making a good point, which I think is part of the heart of the conversation here, which is that the value of your primary home is not a good measure of your ability to pay, right? And so the more it's based on property value, the bigger the problem is. What we really want is we want the best sense. And I think you hear this a lot in Montpelier, is people, neither income nor primary home value is necessarily a perfect measure of your ability to pay, but you're paying your taxes out of your income, right? That's the best measure. And so, when we started public education hundreds of years ago, not a lot of people had jobs outside the home. They didn't have income. So, it made sense at the time that this was a property-based tax. And it just doesn't make sense anymore, right? A lot of people, particularly low and middle-income people, they have mortgages on their homes. So they don't own that whole value, right? And in fact, they might have a negative net worth because they have other debt. They have student loan debt or they have other things. And so, they're not that well off. Meanwhile, at the high end, the primary home value is a very small slice of their net worth, right? So we're sort of punishing the people whose primary home is their main asset by leaning into a property-based tax. So, I think people want a better sense of the whole picture of somebody's net worth so that, there might be wealthy people who, can kind of adjust their income up and down from year to year, and there's concern about that. But we know the income of the people that are paying based on property now, and we know we're not taxing it based on income. So I think, we're sort of missing the Vermonters with the most income, the highest income Vermonters aren't paying based on their income. So it actually is a better deal for them, a property-based tax. So I think I think your point was well taken, that like how property is valued is important, but also recognizing that that value of the primary home is really not a good indicator of people's ability to pay.
Steph, thank you so much. We are out of time for this first half of the Montpelier Happy Hour. So, folks, stay tuned. We're going to hear from some underwriters here on WVEW, LP Brattleboro. And then Steph, you, Jack Hoffman, and I will return in a moment. Welcome back to the second half of the Montpelier Happy Hour here on WVEW LP Brattleboro. And I am your host of the show, Olga Peters. And if you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Steph Yu and Jack Hoffman from the Public Assets Institute. And we're talking school ed funding because there's a lot to talk about.
As everyone is, yes.
I know
Hot
everyone's
topic.
looking at
Hot topic.
We are not alone. Before we dive back into our conversation, I just want to thank BCTV for taking the video version of our show and sharing it with media centers around the state. And just want to remind listeners that the views and opinions of everyone on the Happy Hour belong to the host and the guests and no one else, not the platforms, not their bosses, not the radio station. It's all ours. We take responsibility. And if you ever want to comment on that, you are welcome to send an email to the Montpelier Happy Hour at gmail.com. Quickly, just to remind listeners, in case you're just tuning in, next week I'm also going to be talking with Representative Emily Kornheiser about ed funding. So if you're listening to the show and any questions come up, please send them my way. And I can send them on to Steph or I can send them on to Emily, whoever might be the better person to answer those questions. Sorry, Steph, I just nominated you.
Hey, that's what we do. Happy to do it.
Thank you. In the first half of the show, you both raised an interesting point about some structural changes that both the legislature is putting forward and the governor. And that was talking about a foundation formula, some significant consolidation of school districts, as well as leaning into the property tax as far as a way to raise funds. But it one thing we haven't talked about, Jack, is some of the cost drivers that have really made some of the increases or led to the increases in costs that people have been concerned about. And it does seem to me that you can change a system all you want, but if you're not changing the inputs, or at least having a better understanding of them, maybe a structural change isn't really going to fix anything. So, Jack, would you please highlight some of the cost drivers that we've been dealing with that are kind of exacerbating some of our issues?
Yeah, so the Agency of Education, I thought put out some, very helpful, informative reports last spring. When people were so alarmed at the big increases that we're seeing, last spring when people voting for this was now for the FY25 budget, and started this whole panic and calls for education reform. And I think they fell into three or four general categories. Health insurance, I think it was about a 16% increase overall. I mean, we've seen health insurance increases, not just in schools. We've seen it in a lot of places, but that was a big factor. I'm not sure how much of that was just underlying inflation. Again, another thing that we've had to deal with since COVID was an increase in inflation. And again, I mean, I'm old enough to remember other bouts of inflation, but there are a lot of people who haven't really seen it in a while, and it's a problem. So you had, teacher salaries were increased because of inflation. People need to get paid more in times of inflation. So we saw increases in teachers' contracts. There was a big increase in demand for mental health services. Again, this was related to COVID. We know that there are a lot of lingering problems from COVID. So, those counted for most of the big increases that contributed to double digit budget increases. Well, that they certainly were unusual, but we could see what the causes were. Now, inflation has come down. We haven't gotten a similar report on the 26 budgets, the budgets that just passed this spring. But certainly, there weren't as many, the budget increases weren't as great. Many more budgets passed. We just haven't seen any detail on those sorts of cost drive. What happened with health insurance? What happened with mental health in the 26 budgets? That's information that we'll want to see. But a lot of these structural changes in these two proposals, I mean, going to a foundation plan isn't going to address the healthcare costs. It's not going to address the mental health costs. It's not going to address the inflationary costs. I think we at some point, they as I get further into this plan, we really need to talk about, are these proposals going to solve the problems that set this whole thing off in the first place? Steph should talk about this a little more, but I think what we were really hearing last fall from people was, they wanted tax relief. I don't know that they were necessarily calling for reform of the funding system. They wanted tax relief. They were seeing big increases.
That's a good point.
And we did some work, and Steph has talked about this a lot more than I have, but there are some structural problems in our current system now that allows people to pay based on their income. And Steph can talk about that, but we had some proposals. Those need to be fixed. There's no question about it. And they're hitting people, like when your income goes over a certain threshold, you suddenly can get hit with bigger taxes. But Steph, why don't you talk about the cliffs a little
The cliffs.
bit?
Yeah, I'm happy to jump into that if that's okay, Ova. But I do want to just also add a little bit to what Jack was saying, because he mentioned these big cost drivers. Some of those were pretty much across the board. Teacher healthcare costs were pretty much across the board. Some of them hit some districts much harder than others. Jack mentioned this earlier, but it is really important to note that we're talking about mental health care for kids. We're talking about the demand continues to grow. Some of that is pandemic related. Some of that is technology related. Some of that is sort of a reflection of other challenges in society. And the schools are the backstop for these things, as they should be, right? Like services should get delivered through schools because that's where the kids are, and it's an effective system. But in terms of those costs hitting districts differently, that makes us extra wary of kind of a one size fits all approach when these costs are not hitting districts the same way. The other thing I think Jack's bringing up is like, and this gets into sort of where the heart of our concerns are in terms of what's unfair about who pays now. I think it's worth making a distinction between, nobody likes their property tax bill, nobody likes their school tax bill. Part of why we focus on it is because it is a really visible tax, right? If you have a mortgage, it might be part of your monthly escrow. But for some people, you're getting a big bill once or twice a year, and it kind of smacks you in the face in a way that your income tax and your sales tax doesn't, right? So people are more disgruntled about property taxes generally because they're more visible and more striking.
And I think for a lot of people, what you're paying for is also invisible.
I think that's there's some truth to that too, absolutely. And but I also still want to make a distinction between the people complaining because that who can afford to pay, and the people who are complaining, who are genuinely being squeezed by other sort of economic insecurity issues, wages not keeping up with inflation to that point, the cost of housing, the cost of healthcare, really straining a lot of Vermonters' budgets, and sort of recognizing who's in that boat versus people who don't like tax increases but could afford it and probably have been getting a break by paying on property all along anyway. So maybe that's a different, that's less, that's not a problem we necessarily see that needs solving. That in fact we'd go the other direction and ask higher income people to contribute more. But so to Jack's point about these cliffs, so what we have is income sensitivity. So, and we talk about people pay based on income or they pay based on property, but it's a system that's based on some thresholds. So below 47,000, your what you contribute in school taxes is capped at a percentage of your income. And then there's this $90,000 threshold where above 90,000, you also pay a property piece on any part of your property value over 225,000. And so you're paying both an income and a property-based piece. And those two thresholds, the 47,000 hasn't been changed since even before Jack remembers, before 1985, right? Like before Brigham, well, a very 40 years, right? Decades. And then that $90,000 threshold hasn't been updated since 2008, which was 17 years ago. Maybe it doesn't sound like it was 17 years ago, but that was a long time ago, right? And then the property value threshold's at 225,000, and also everybody pays a property amount on anything above 400,000. As you might imagine, with property values growing, more and more Vermonters are crossing those thresholds. More and more Vermonters are falling into those cliffs. And what happens there is if they pay both an income and a property piece, those are the people paying the biggest share of their income in school taxes. So the middle is being squeezed the most. The moderate income folks are being squeezed the most. If you're over that 47,000 and if you're over that 90,000, over the 90,000 and over the 225 in property value. And we can share some links to some more information about this. There's a lot of information on our website that kind of describes this a little bit more clearly. But it's squeezing these low and moderate income Vermonters more. Those thresholds haven't been updated for inflation in decades. And so income sensitivity is not working as well as it used to. And that those are the people we're most concerned about. We're concerned about the people paying the biggest share, those low and moderate income people. And that happens whether their school budgets go up or not. You get an extra dollar in income and suddenly you're facing, maybe even as much as double the bill. So we want to be real clear that a system that where the middle is paying the most is a problem, right? And not only that, but also a lot of lower income people are paying a much bigger share of their income in school taxes than the highest income people. So, that's a regressive system, and that's part of what we see as the unfairness. So, and that's something that they can fix right away and will provide property tax relief to a whole lot of Vermonters if you just updated those thresholds for inflation. You wouldn't have to make big structural changes. You could just tweak those numbers and you'd make a big difference in people's bills right away. You know,
Interesting.
our proposal has always been that it would be good to go to income-based school taxes for all resident homeowners, over the long term. That would take a little bit more of a runway and some, a longer time to implement. But you could fix those thresholds right away and make a big difference and provide that property tax relief that I think people were really calling for in November.
Thank you, Steph. I think that would be very eye-opening for a lot of folks. I'm curious, I'd like to touch on another cost driver that neither of you have mentioned, but I'm hearing a lot in the statewide discussion, and that it's the idea that one of the cost drivers is local communities or local voters are spending more money. They're voting for higher budgets, their school budgets, and that's one of the cost drivers is decisions that are being made at the local level. Just curious from your perspective, does that feel accurate? Does that feel like yes, but can we expand on that?
Well, the way the system works now, it's the system is designed to let local communities decide how much they want to spend per pupil. But if they spend more, their taxes are higher. So, I think that's the way a democratic system works. If people decide they want to spend more money and they vote to tax themselves more accordingly, who's to tell them that they shouldn't be spending what they think they should be spending on their own children?
But how is that like when, because we are dealing with a statewide taxing system, how are those local decisions, are they having, what kind of knock-on effects are they having for everybody else? I think that's one of the concerns that's being brought up.
That your decision is affecting my taxes. Yeah, go ahead, Jack.
Not very much, actually. It's certainly, if everybody spends more, taxes are going to go up. There's no question about it. But the effect on everybody else is pretty minimal compared to what happens to the local taxpayer. So, if they decide to increase their per pupil spending by 10%, they're taking the brunt of that 10% increase. That how that gets spread out in the rest of the other towns, how it gets spread out through the rest of the Ed Fund, is minimal. This is getting a little bit in the weeds.
That's
I've heard
okay.
some people complain that wealthier towns, it's not fair because it's easier for them to spend more money, and that's raising taxes on not as wealthy towns. Well, the truth is that the way the system works, if the wealthy towns are spending more money, it's actually less of a drain on the Ed Fund than if poorer communities are. So it's I know people talk about this a lot. I've looked at it in quite a lot of detail. There's just isn't It just isn't that big a factor on everybody else. Now, certainly, if there was one town that wanted to keep their spending low and everybody else spent more money, that would, that one town would clearly have higher taxes than they would if, they were just on their own. But, we had a system for a long time where towns were essentially on their own, and it was a lot harder on many more towns than the system we have now. I mean, I think, we switched to we've solved a problem that a lot of other states still struggle with, which is the problem of, wealthy communities could always afford to spend more on their kids and with lower tax rates than the poorer communities. This was the problem Vermont had before Act 60. Towns just didn't have the wherewithal. They were willing to pay, very high tax rates, and they just couldn't generate much money. So this, this problem of, wealthy towns and poor towns is a has been a problem across the country. But, Vermont has dealt with it quite well in that, we created a statewide pool. We essentially share the, whatever resources we put into education are accessible to all kids in the state. So, I think we should be a little more appreciative of, what we've achieved in the last 25 years.
But can I, do we have time for me to add something to that or
Oh,
no?
yes, we do,
Okay.
please.
Well, I mean, but I also want to get to why people think that, right? Because I think to your point, like, I think what people get frustrated about is what they vote on for their school budget doesn't match what happens to their tax bill. Like their tax bill is being sometimes being driven up by more than what they raise their school budget by. And so who are they going to blame? They're going to blame this town over here. They're going to blame the state. Like it doesn't make sense, right? It doesn't feel like it makes sense to them. And I will say a lot of that is driven by the property tax piece of the puzzle.
Oh,
Because
interesting.
what happens is if property values in your town go up more than the state average, your expected contribution to the ed fund increases because you have a bigger share of the tax base. So it's a lot of that disconnect is driven by the property value side of the equation. If we move to income-based taxes, you get rid of a lot of that confusion and complexity around the property tax side of things. So I think that is part of the frustration that people feel like, well, we didn't raise our budget that much, but somehow our taxes went up. And there's a lot of factors that go into what the tax rate is that are out of the local district's control. The only one they really have control over is their per pupil spending, is their education spending. But they might have kids coming and going, changes in enrollment, and then there's changes in property values. And so there's, and then there's how much is the sales tax this year? How much do we have to raise on the other pieces? So there's a lot of moving parts. And that's part of why we think moving to income-based taxes makes a lot more sense because it really reduces that disconnect and the complexity and the number of moving parts. So I think it makes the tax bill much more straightforward for Vermonters, and I think that would go a long way toward, sort of communities being able to focus on what kids need rather than what's going to happen to their tax bill because the system would be fair.
I think you raise a very, very good point, Steph, is that because a lot of people don't understand why the money or their tax bill is doing this, it gives the impression that the system isn't working. And I just think it's a very, I'm so glad you raised that point because when people feel the system's not working, that's or they don't understand it, that's when frustration really starts climbing.
Absolutely, absolutely. And yeah, and I there was no question that there was a significant increase in tax in both spending and tax bills. One factor that we didn't mention, though, is the loss of the COVID era ESSER funds, right? We did have some federal money in there, and that went that it was sort of a perfect storm in FY25. And I do think we saw FY26, the budgets we just passed, get a little bit back to baseline. I mean, to Jack's point, we don't have all the numbers yet, but obviously, most budgets passed. There weren't as big of an increase as there had been in FY25. So maybe, maybe systems are sort of coming back to baseline. And to Jack's point about we really have made it fairer for towns. It's really less driven by the wealth of the towns. Jack's done a bunch of work on sort of like who are the low spenders and who are the high spenders, and they're not the same from year to year. I think
Oh,
that's sort of the
interesting.
most, there are very few towns that are consistently in the lowest 25 and very few towns that are consistently in the highest. It's really people are coming and going because there might be a change to enrollment or, a construction project that they have to deal with, or, there are things that come and go, which also, makes us a little skeptical of sort of the one size fits all approach too.
Well, that's one thing. We only have 5 minutes left, so hopefully this will be a quick question. It's often feels to me like to really address the needs of local schools, we need a system that's very nimble. And yet to achieve economies of scale, we that kind of happens for such a small state at the state level. But it just feels like there's so much tension there. Given what the governor's proposing and what the House is proposing, are they proposing systems that are nimble enough to kind of flex and change as schools flex and change?
I can't remember what the House bill says about staffing. I think, in the last couple of years they have added staff a little bit, but the Agency of Education has lost a lot of people over the years. I want to say this started in the early 2000s, is my recollection.
There needs to be more centralized support for sure.
Yeah, there needs to be. I think, there are a lot of local, school districts who recognize they need some help. And I think they would like to see more help from the agency, and I think that just means, the legislature needs to fund the agency better and increase their staffing again so
But
that
not necessarily dictates from the agency, right? And I think it's worth noting to your point about nimble, schools turned on a dime during the pandemic to really create a whole different system. And there were a lot of, federal resources and other supports that went into making that possible. But I do think I think that is one of the concerns, is again, sort of the further removed the decision making gets from the local community, it's harder to react to those kind of changes. And figure out what needs to be done, quickly.
Well, I also asked the question too, because right now we're looking at a system that's based on, in part, based on declining enrollments. And yet we want, as a state, to attract more new Vermonters, attract more new families. And so if we do that right, we will have increased enrollments and the system will need to respond to that. And I'm just wondering if it would be able to, given if we're looking at declining enrollments now, does that make sense?
Absolutely. And I think it's a great question. I think there is some sort of, there's some ways in which our policy is at odds. We do a lot to support community schools and small schools, but then we're looking at consolidation. Like, how do these things all go together? And to your point, yes, we're trying to attract more people, but and yet we're also trying to have the to, I think there's people that sort of see this as right sizing the education system. But how do you make it flexible? And I think that's a big part of our questions too about the kind of going to a foundation approach is like, how do you get from where we are to there? And then how do you keep it flexible? I think a lot of this is some of the ideal school sizes and the ideal district sizes are pretty hard to achieve in Vermont. And we don't have the school buildings right now that would get to a lot of those numbers. So, I think those are really good questions about how do we retain that flexibility? And I think, again, I always vote for more community engagement, not less, in order to address some of those questions.
We only have a few minutes left, and we do want to talk about community engagement. But before we do that, it just occurred to me, Stephanie, that if someone came in on the second half, they may not know what a foundation formula is. Can you give us the elevator pitch?
The short version is that the state would decide how much to spend per pupil, and then everybody would spend the same. There would be adjustments for pupil weights and a few other things, but it's basically the state decides one number, one size fits all across the whole state, which is very different than what we have now, where each community decides for themselves.
Thank you. Quickly, one of the concerns that has come up for both of you, looking at what's happening right now, with ed reform at both the governor's side and the legislative side, is concerns around democratic participation, local participation. Could you just touch on that before we head out? Because I think that's an important part.
There's two big ways I think that there's really a significant diminishment of community participation. One is just that they no longer decide the amount to spend. So this foundation approach, they no longer decide the amount to spend. But I also think these big districts, the bigger the districts, the more removed the school board is from the individual communities, the fewer, just the fewer school board members participating, period. But also the ways in which people go to those school board meetings and participate and have conversations and talk to those school board members. I think those are our big concerns about ways to get it right. And I think it gets to your point that there's a suspicion that local voters are making bad decisions. And so the answer is to take the control away from local voters. And our argument would be like, how can we help them make better decisions if that's true? First of all, we trust their decision making. But second of all, we want to clear away some of the unfairnesses and make sure that they have good information going into those decisions.
Thank you. Jack, anything you want to add before we wrap up?
This isn't work that we've done, but other people have looked, they looked at the at participation, not this spring, but last spring, with the big budget increases, and they found that if, I think I've got this right, that the school budgets in the larger recently merged districts didn't seem to be getting as much support as the smaller districts or the ones that hadn't been consolidated. So I think there is some hard evidence about the relationship between consolidation and public participation. And I mean, we know now that it's hard for some people to come before their local school board and talk about what's going on. And I just think that the bigger that is, the more formalized it becomes, the more professionalized you're just going to it's going to be too daunting for a lot of people. And again, I think, the closer you are to the community, the more likely you are to get more participation.
Thank you very much. Well, we could keep talking about this issue forever and ever and ever. Unfortunately, we are out of time here today. So I want to thank Steph Yu and Jack Hoffman from the Public Assets Institute for joining us today. If folks want to read some of the work you've done on ed financing and state money in general, economic issues in general, where can they find that information, Steph?
There's a lot of information on our website at publicassets.org. We're also, on Instagram and LinkedIn and all those places. We also have a coalition site with a number of partners at publicschoolsvt.org that has a lot of information about this as well.
Thank you. And on that note, unfortunately, we are out of time. So I want to thank listeners for joining us today. The Montpelier Happy Hour is on WVEW LP Brattleboro every Friday at 2. Every Wednesday, it is rebroadcasted. And of course, you can always reach me at the Montpelier Happy Hour at gmail.com. Have a good weekend, everybody.